Welcome to the Audio Digest of the American Journal of Psychiatry. This is Dr. Susan Schultz with highlights for January 2017. We'll discuss deep brain stimulation in Parkinson's disease, how to differentiate its effects from the effects of the disease itself, and the influence of life events. We'll also review the association of hypnotic medications and suicide, and look at neurometabolic disorders in patients with treatment-refractory depression. And in toddlers with autism spectrum disorder, research investigated whether their diminished attention to other people's eyes is due to gaze aversion or gaze indifference. We also have two articles on diagnosis. One examines increased activity or energy as a primary criterion for diagnosis of bipolar mania. The other reports on an instrument for diagnosing premenstrual dysphoric disorder. This article has been selected as meriting CME for readers who subscribe to the AJP CME course program. Each month, brief companion exams are created for three articles from the issue. By reading the articles and completing the online exam, individuals can earn up to one AMA PRA Category 1 credit per article. This activity is sponsored by the American Psychiatric Association. To subscribe, click on the CME link at the top of our homepage, ajp.psychiatryonline.org. We'll start the highlights with our clinical case conference. Deep brain stimulation, or DBS, is a dramatic and effective treatment for motor symptoms related to Parkinson's disease. It's been associated with significant adverse behavioral effects in some patients, but not all behavioral and mood changes are related to DBS. Rachel Davis and colleagues present the case of a man whose psychosocial conflict and alcohol use contributed to his behavioral problems. Adverse behavioral effects of DBS in Parkinson's patients aren't well understood. Premorbid mental illness increases the risk of psychiatric adverse effects, and active psychiatric disorders are a contraindication to DBS. Behavioral effects can also be related to DBS characteristics, such as stimulation parameters and electrode configuration. Most commonly, the electrodes are placed in the subthalamic nucleus, but they can also be placed in the globus pallidus pars interna. A meta-analysis showed that the two locations produced equal improvement in motor symptoms, but the globus pallidus location produced greater improvement in depression. The subthalamic nucleus location was more effective in reducing dopaminergic medication, which can have the additional benefit of improving impulse control. After implantation of the DBS programmable generator, adjustments to the settings may be needed. When attempting to reduce adverse behavioral effects, the programmer can shift electrical stimulation away from the limbic and associative circuits within the subthalamic nucleus by selecting more dorsal active contacts. If mood or behavior changes are not preceded by recent changes in DBS programming, other factors warrant evaluation. Medication changes, dementia, and the Parkinson's disease itself are possible contributors. A psychiatric evaluation may also be helpful. It can reveal substance use disorders, a primary mood or psychotic disorder, and psychosocial stressors. Interventions to address these problems may result in substantial improvement. Our review article this month is about possible connections between hypnotic medications and suicide. insomnia itself is associated with increased risk for suicide. But it's also been claimed that hypnotic medications increase suicide risk. Von McCall and colleagues examined the literature and FDA reports to investigate this claim. They focused on modern FDA-approved hypnotics, beginning with the introduction of benzodiazepines. Studies show that hypnotics have frequently been taken before suicide deaths. Some suicides have been reported from overdoses of a single hypnotic, but the hypnotics are often taken in combination with other sedatives or alcohol. Data are also available for one specific drug. The clinical trials of suvorexant prospectively measured suicidal ideation. The pooled data may suggest a dose-response relationship between suvorexant exposure and risk of suicidal ideation. However, the risk was small. A separate concern is that benzodiazepine receptor agonist hypnotics can cause parasomnias. In rare cases, these may lead to suicidal ideation or behavior in people not known to be suicidal. Research is currently testing whether treatment of insomnia can actually reduce suicidality in depressed adults. It has been shown that the addition of an FDA-approved hypnotic to an antidepressant improves the overall rate of response to the antidepressant. Next, we'll turn to autism spectrum disorder. A diagnostic hallmark of autism is reduced attention to other people's eyes. This could be due to gaze aversion or gaze indifference. The two ideas posit different areas of atypical brain function, different pathogenic models, and different possible treatments. Jennifer Moriucci and Warren Jones evaluated both hypotheses in 2-year-old children. Children with autism spectrum disorder, or ASD, were matched to typically developing children. 2 experiments were conducted. The first one measured the children's response to direct cues to look at the eyes in faces appearing in photographs. If the hypothesis of gaze aversion was correct, the children would look away from the eyes sooner. The second experiment used implicit cues in a video to direct the children to look at the eyes. The gaze indifference hypothesis predicted that the children with ASD would be less likely than the healthy children to look at the person's eyes. The results were inconsistent with gaze aversion. The toddlers with ASD did generally look less at the eyes, but this tendency could be overridden by direct cueing for eye looking. It wasn't driven by implicit social cueing. When directly cued to look at the eyes, the toddlers with ASD did not look away faster than typically developing children. The effects of direct cueing were actually stronger in the children with ASD. Moreover, when they were presented with implicit social cues for eye looking, there was no evidence that they shifted their gaze away from the eyes. Since the children with ASD appeared to be indifferent to implicit social cues, interventions aimed at enhancing social engagement and social motivation may be indicated. Now we'll look at a possible factor in treatment-resistant depression. Lisa Pan and colleagues previously identified a patient with refractory depression and multiple suicide attempts who had a severe neurometabolic deficiency. Treatment of the condition led to a dramatic and long-lasting remission of the depression. The authors have now conducted a case-control metabolic evaluation of patients with treatment-resistant depression and healthy comparison subjects. The metabolic testing profiled plasma, urine, and CSF samples. None of the healthy comparison subjects had a metabolic abnormality. On the other hand, 21 of the 33 patients with refractory depression had CSF metabolic abnormalities. The most common was cerebral folate deficiency with normal serum folate levels. All of the patients with cerebral folate deficiency showed improvements in depressive symptoms after treatment with folinic acid. The study could not determine whether the metabolic abnormalities were primary or secondary. However, the patients had no other overt clinical disease. Secondary deficiencies related to other systemic conditions are unlikely. Now we'll turn to the diagnosis of premenstrual dysphoric disorder. Most clinicians rely on patients' retrospective reports of symptoms to diagnose premenstrual dysphoric disorder. These ratings are unreliable and don't consistently map to prospectively reported premenstrual symptoms. In research settings, diagnosis is often made by visual inspection of daily symptom ratings. Tori Eisenlohr-Mowell and colleagues report on a new instrument for diagnosis, the Carolina Premenstrual Assessment Scoring System, or CPAS. The scale uses 2 or more months of daily symptom ratings. 5 symptoms must be present, and 1 must be a core emotional symptom. The symptoms are reported during the premenstrual week and the subsequent follicular week. They're counted if they show premenstrual elevation and postmenstrual clearance, and they must be present in at least 2 cycles. The symptoms must also be sufficiently severe and prolonged to cause significant distress or impairment. The CPAS was tested in 200 women with retrospectively reported premenstrual emotional symptoms. They provided 2 to 4 months of daily symptom ratings. Diagnostic prevalence was affected by the method of calculation and by the threshold for symptoms. The highest agreement with expert clinical diagnosis of menstrually related mood disorder was provided by setting the threshold at 30% and by basing the calculation on the range of the scale used by the individual woman. The agreement of the CPAS diagnosis with expert clinical diagnosis was excellent. The overall correct classification was 98%. As in earlier studies, retrospective reports of premenstrual symptoms were a poor predictor of prospective CPAS diagnosis. The diagnosis of bipolar disorder is our next topic. Increased energy or activity is a core symptom of manic and hypomanic episodes in DSM-5, but it was a secondary criterion in DSM-4. This could have led to an overdiagnosis of hypomania by focusing on mild positive changes in mood without taking into account activity levels. Rodrigo Machado Vieira and colleagues estimated the effect of requiring increased activity on the prevalence of bipolar mania. The data were from STEP-BD, the Systematic Treatment Enhancement Program for Bipolar Disorder. More than 4,000 patients were interviewed at baseline and over the following year. Diagnoses were determined according to both DSM-4 and DSM-5 criteria. About 300 patients received a DSM-4 diagnosis of manic or hypomanic episode. Applying the DSM-5 criteria reduced the frequency of mania or hypomania by nearly 50%. A large percentage of those who didn't meet DSM-5 criteria for mania did meet the criteria for major depressive episode with mixed features. Despite the difference in prevalence of mania and hypomania, no difference was seen in clinical ratings at the 1-year follow-up between patients who met the DSM-5 criteria at baseline and in those who did not. both groups improved over time. This concludes our audio highlights of the January issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. Please visit our website, ajp.psychiatryonline.org, for the complete versions of these and other articles. We also welcome comments. They can be emailed to ajp@psych.org. Next month, our topics will include use of stimulants and performance enhancers during and after trauma exposure, neural substrates of overgeneralized conditioned fear in PTSD, patient expectancy as a mediator of placebo effects, epidemiology of first episode psychosis, and predicting suicidal behavior from longitudinal health records. We hope you'll join us. Thank you for listening.